A new documentary called Lipstick and Dynamite tells the story of the early days of women's professional wrestling.
You had to give June Byers back what she delivered, or she'd rip you to pieces. She had a June Byers slap. She would take an open hand like this and right between the throat and your breastbone right here. She would lay that thing in, and not only would it sting, it damn near knocked your head off.
That was former wrestler Ella Waldeck describing what it was like to go up against a particularly tough opponent named June Byers. Many of the lady wrestlers of the 40s, 50s, and 60s came from broken homes and tough backgrounds to find careers as part fighters, part entertainers, and always pawns to promoters in the male-dominated business. With names like Killam Gillam and the great Mae Young, they pulled hair and hammered each other around the ring on cards dominated by male wrestlers. One of the women featured in Lipstick and Dynamite is Lillian Ellison, who wrestled under the name The Fabulous Moolah. Unlike most of the women in the documentary, she's managed to stay in the business as a promoter and recently as a wrestler again, even though she's in her 80s. While women in the film who long ago left the ring share perspectives ranging from nostalgia to bitterness, Moolah still carries the bravado of a performer who'll tell you she can beat women and men a quarter her age. I recently spoke with the Fabulous Moolah and with filmmaker Ruth Lightman, who produced and directed Lipstick and Dynamite. I asked Lightman how women first got into wrestling.
There was a legacy that led back to the late 30s, that there were these women from economically challenged backgrounds that were recruited to the road by one promoter named Billy Wolf, and he basically had men, other wrestlers who were wrestling in territories all over the country that would see women in diners and in shopping centers, and he would pick them up and offer them $50 and send them to Columbus, Ohio for a chance at becoming a wrestler.
What were they looking for? Beauty, brawn, skill?
All of the above. Beauty, brawn, skill. They were looking for women who were very attractive and very athletic, and often on the spot they would say, you know, get down there and do some sit-ups for me, or show me what you can do, do push-ups. And so many of them were acrobatic and athletic, and they would perform for the chance to, basically, they were offered fame, fortune. Many of these women were sort of presented and marketed like movie stars. They wore furs and high-heeled shoes, and they were presented as showgirls.
As we listen to the stories of these women and how they got into it, I mean, there's some pretty tough survival stories here, aren't there?
They really were looking for a way out of some difficult home lives, so that they learned how to fight when they were young, because many of them came from abusive homes. They were ready to get out there and get into the ring. But it was also a way for them to have a career, and they really perceived it as a career, and some of them were able to do it for decades, especially Lillian and Mae Young.
It's interesting. It seems as if some of the common denominators among the women who were selected by promoters for these early days of lady wrestling were women who were attractive but very, very tough, and from backgrounds that they really wanted to get away from. As these women described things that happened in the ring, I mean, there was some pretty mean stuff. I mean, there was biting and hair pulling and throwing people around the ring, which is part of wrestling, but it also seemed like it was done, you know, with intent to inflict some pain at times. And I'm wondering how they got along on the road, all these ladies. I mean, did they have the respect that athletes have for one another, or were they more like, prisoners on D block?
Well, I don't think they got along so well on the road. I think that there were some that were able to travel in pairs, and even some of the women talk about their tag team partners trying to upstage them. Penny Banner talks about her tag team partner promising to wake her up so that they could both be the same amount of suntan before they got into the ring that day, and Lorraine Johnson beat her to it. I think that was another thing, is that when women wrestled in tag teams as tag team partners, they tried to make them look exactly the same, exactly same build. As a matter of fact, Penny Banner tells a story that they asked Lorraine Johnson to gain a few pounds and Penny to lose a few pounds so that they were the exact same weight. And it was all really for the titillation of the crowd.
It's interesting when you look at the pictures in the film of women wrestling. I mean, and they, you know, they're attractive young women in, I guess, what would look something like bathing suits. But it also appears that in the early days they were seen as something like a sideshow attraction. I mean, somebody in the movie says that, well, they'd either have a midget or they'd have some other gimmick, and sometimes it was women. Were they real competitives or were they a sideshow?
They started out as a sideshow on the carnival where they would take all comers. Mildred Burke, who was the champion, there would be a purse of $10 for anyone who would go out there and challenge her. And once they started, and, you know, anyone could challenge their boys, men, other women. And so here were these athletic women from all over the country, a woman who worked for a lumber company or someone who worked on a farm, and that they would have their opportunity to get into the ring. When Billy Wolfe saw how these women would draw the crowds, he decided to put them into the arenas. So, they were actually first a sideshow. They were an attraction. They were brought in on the card to bring the attendances up when they were falling. And as Carl Lauer, gentleman in the film, states that they were basically an attraction. They brought in women, or they brought in midgets, or they brought in a woman wrestling a bear or an alligator to keep the attendance up. But the male wrestlers still got the bulk of the money, and they were still the headliners.
What did these women do after they left the ring? And how well did it prepare them for a different life?
I think that being in the wrestling ring, and I think that they would certainly all agree, that it prepared them for a lot of things in life that followed. Gladys Killam Gillam, who also states that she could never win. She says in the film that she never won a match. Because she wasn't supposed to. She wasn't one of Billy's favorites. So she decided that she had a family to take care of, and she decided to go into other parts of show business, and she became a lion tamer, and she became, she wrestled alligators and bears after that. And Ella Waldeck went into law enforcement, and Penny Banner went into real estate, and also she's a senior Olympian today.
Yeah, I was just going to say, a lot of them seem to be smart, self-confident women, you know, that have really achieved some things.
Oh, they definitely are, and I think that Ida has accomplished so much in her life. And then the other two that did not go on to other things are Lillian Ellison and the Fabulous Moolah, and the Great Mae Young, who are still working today in wrestling.
And I think that's probably a good point. We can bring Lillian Ellison, the Fabulous Moolah, into the conversation. Are you with us, Moolah?
Yes, I am.
Great. Should I call you Lillian or Moolah?
Whatever you want to, but if you write a check, just don't let it bounce.
All right.
I've been called a lot of things. I don't mind.
All right. Now, it said you held the world title for 28 years, going back to 1956, right?
Yes, sir. I won it in Baltimore, Maryland in 1956 and lost it in Madison Square Garden in 1985.
Take us back to those days in the 50s a little bit. What were a couple of your favorite moves in the ring?
Favorite moves?
Yeah.
Anything I could get to win. I like to do the flying drop kicks and flying head scissors, and like to do flying mares.
Well, describe a couple of those for us.
Okay, a flying drop kick is when you jump flat-footed from the floor up as high as the person you're looking at and kick them in the face or in the chest, wherever you want to kick them, and then you fall to the floor. And then the flying head scissors is where you jump up, would put both legs around their head and throw them forward as you come down. And a flying mare is when you get a girl by the hair of the head and pull her over your shoulders and flam her to the mat as hard as you can. And I love doing that.
I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what it was like in the ring and the crowd. I mean, they're yelling at you. Did you feed off the crowd? Could you hear individual people yelling at you?
Well, I would tell you, it's kind of hard to explain, but it it just gives me a joy when I walk out to the ring and I hear people yelling. I don't care if they're yelling or booing. It just gives me a thrill to know that the people are there to enjoy themselves and enjoy the entertainment that we will be giving them. And then it's hard to explain, because like in the city in New York, I would go in the ring and I get everything thrown at me, from rotten eggs to rotten oranges and everything else. And then when I'd come out of the ring, they'd be tapping me on my back and saying, "Mula, we love you. You're so great. We love you." So it's hard to explain.
When you're in your ring, did you ever turn around and respond to anybody?
Oh, I yell back a lot, yeah.
Like, what would you say?
Well, I don't know, whatever it called for.
Lillian, why do you think you...
I would tell them to shut up, or if they thought they were big enough to climb inside the ring, I had something waiting for them, whatever I felt like telling them.
Were there rules? A lot of people, when they see wrestling, it looks like anything goes. I mean, were there rules about what you couldn't do in the ring? Like, for example, grabbing someone by their hair and throwing them into a turnbuckle.
Yes, there's rules, but everybody does not abide by the rules. And I'm one of them.
You're one that does not
always. I do my own rules. In fact, I don't mind wrestling men because I know their weak points.
Give me an example of their weak points. can you give an example of a rule that you bend?
Well, I wouldn't mind choking you, or gouging your eyes, pulling your hair, or kicking you below the belt. It wouldn't bother me at all.
Okay, well, I'm glad we're in two different cities here. Most of the other women in the film, Lipstick and Dynamite, went on to other careers, but Mula, you just stayed right in it. And I'm wondering, did you ever think about leaving? What kept you in the wrestling game all your life?
What has really kept me in it so long is that every year I got older, I could see people, senior citizens, sitting in a rocking chair, or either saying, "Oh well, I'm going to retire this year," and when you do that, you can bet one thing, you're driving nails in your coffin. And I will be wrestling when I'm 100 years old, and I want the senior citizens to know, just because they're 60 to 65 years old, they do not have to sit in a rocking chair and rock, because when they do, they're rocking themselves to the grave.
All right, well, I'm gonna let you go, and let me just ask you, Mula, you are still going after, what, 5 decades in the ring. How long do you plan to keep wrestling?
Till I'm 100. That's not far off.
All right, well, we'll book a ticket for that that match. Thank you so much. The fabulous Mula wrestler Lillian Ellison. She's one of the lady wrestlers profiled in Lipstick and Dynamite, the new documentary about women's professional wrestling. We also spoke with the director of the film, Ruth Lightman. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.